Burada.
Kadın. Kadın has lots of problems. I'll read it then. If there were no need of self-finding, but only an eternal enjoyment of this play of the being of Satchidananda, and such an eternal enjoyment is the nature of certain supreme states of conscious existence, then evolution and rebirth need not have come into operation. But there has been an involution of this unity into the dividing mind, a plunge into self-oblivion by which the ever-present sense of the complete oneness is lost, and the play of separative difference, phenomenal because the real unity in difference remains unabridged behind, comes into the forefront as a dominant reality. This play of difference has found its utmost term of the sense of division by the precipitation of the dividing mind into a form of body in which it becomes conscious of itself as a separate ego. A dense and solid basis has been laid for this play of division in a world of separated forms of matter by an involution of the active self-conscience of Satchidananda into a phenomenal nescience. It is this foundation in nescience that makes the division secure, because it imperatively opposes a return to the consciousness of unity. But still, though effectively obstructive, it is phenomenal and terminable, because within it, above it, supporting it, is the all-conscient spirit, and the apparent nescience turns out to be only a concentration, an exclusive action of consciousness tranced into self-forgetfulness by an abysmal plunge into the absorption of the formative and creative material process. In a phenomenal universe so created, the separative form becomes the foundation and the starting point of all its life action. Therefore, the individual Purusha, in working out its cosmic relations with the One, has in this physical world to base himself upon the form, to assume a body. It is the body that he must make his own foundation and the starting point for his development of the life and mind and spirit in the physical existence. That assumption of body we call birth, and in it only can take place here the development of self and the play of relations between the individual and the universal and all other individuals. In it only can there be the growth of a progressive development of our conscious being towards the supreme recovery of unity with God and with all in God. All the sum of what we call life in the physical world is a progress of the soul and proceeds by birth into the body and has that for its fulcrum, its condition of action, and its condition of evolutionary persistence.
So we had actually read this paragraph last time. And I had mentioned at the time that this paragraph is a crucial one in understanding how this entry of the spirit, which is one indivisible being, to a manifestation in which it becomes many, is secured, as he says. But it is more than that, because it is not merely the one becoming many, but the one entering into an evolutionary process. That is the question here. And that's why he begins this paragraph by talking about the fact that there could have been, and maybe there is, parallelly with this universe, other universes, or another universe at least. Satchidananda enjoys the play of the one and the many in a kind of unveiled form without any idea or principle behind it, as a play of delight. But that would not explain the fact of evolution in this manifestation in which we find ourselves, nor would it explain the need for rebirth. So these are the two things that stand in the way, that are deficiencies in the Vaishnava notion of Leela. Leela being an unveiled play of the divine as an explanation for reality here. So since he has posited that as the very meaning, the becoming of the one into the many, so as to enjoy the play of difference in oneness, as he calls it somewhere, we have to explain that in terms of the fact of evolution here, as well as of the fact of the rebirth of being, taking on evolutionary forms and progressing in nature bodies. So that explanation he gives us over here, and it is an explanation which actually connects us with the source of the knowledge and the source of the ignorance, vidya and avidya. That is what he explains in the first part of that page 757. He talks about the fact that to explain this evolution, the only way to do it is to assume an involution. There has been an involution of this unity into the dividing mind, a plunge into self-oblivion by which the ever-present sense of the complete oneness is lost, and the play of separative difference phenomenal, because the real unity in difference remains unabridged behind, comes into the forefront as a dominant reality. So here a reality is created where there is an appearance and a truth. The truth is that the one has become many without any abridging or any lessening of its sense of oneness. This is done by the faculty of the supermind that Sri Aurobindo calls prajnana. Prajnana is the ability of the one to project its infinite possibilities as realities in themselves, and to hold these in an apprehending consciousness, as he says. However, this is the truth of the coexistence of the one and the many, and there is also an appearance of this reality which is effected through an act of consciousness. This act of consciousness suppresses the sense of unity, so that there is the sense of multiplicity only, the many without the one. It is not the many as the one, but the many in themselves. Now this change in principle is then given a secure foundation in manifestation. And that happens through two stages. The first stage is to establish a process of prakriti, which is universal or cosmic. A universal or cosmic creation of principles of devolution. In other words, it is as if the one, to become many, has to create new principles of itself. These are the principles of mind, life, and matter. And it is in matter that ultimately we find the effective transformation of unity to multiplicity. Because that is where continuity becomes discreteness. That we have particulate differentiation that is impossible to spirit. So that particular switch the switch from continuity to discreteness affects itself fully in the principle, the cosmic principle of matter. Now that makes it possible for a play of unity and indifference within the manifestation. But to now make that into a reality, an evolving reality, the second stage comes in. And the second stage is spirit mobilizes its cosmic principle of mind to focus its oneness into multiple forms that will ultimately be housed in the discrete principle of matter. So this plunging not merely into a self-forgetfulness, which is the self-forgetfulness of matter in a cosmic principle, but also a plunge of its oneness into each of these discrete possibilities that can be housed in matter, are the two stages by which spirit becomes manifested in multiplicity in a secure form. That's why he says, uses that wonderful sort of sentence where he says, a dense and solid basis has been laid for this play of division in a world of separative forms of matter by an involution of the active self-conscience of Satchidananda in a phenomenal nescience. So that, one may say, second entry of spirit, the individualized entry or the individuation of spirit in matter, is the descent of the cosmic Purusha. It is the holocaust of the Purusha. And that holocaust of the Purusha housing itself, it's based, one may say, in the holocaust of Prakriti. Prakriti's holocaust comes first. The self denial of the cosmic reality of the divine, of the nature of the divine, which will become the house of the entry of spirit into those various forms and bodies. And that is indeed what starts the process of evolution. Because now there is an evolution both of nature and of spirit, of consciousness. Consciousness housed in nature and using it as an instrumental abode for its self-manifestation. This evolution is accomplished both through external processes of nature as well as through internal processes of Purusha, which is what we know as rebirth. So the first step in that is the reality called birth. Birth symbolizes or represents the plunge of Purusha into its seeming opposite, the particulate reality of matter. And that symbol is repeated every time somebody is born, because in a sense, it is a remembrance of that original process by which the evolution of spirit into its multiple forms of being is accomplishing itself in the universe.
Devishishta, it's not just human birth, right? Any birth.
Yes, yes. It's only in the human birth that this process becomes self-conscious, because as we were discussing last time, psychic being makes its appearance, and in psychic being's appearance, the transcendental Purusha becomes self-represented in a latent form. It is in the human being that we find something which is created in the image of God, which has the possibility of the manifestation of divine reality as a Purusha.
Devashishda, when we say the involution, when we say the involution preceded, the involution of the self-conscience of Sachidananda, is the involution taking place against a backdrop of time, or is the process of involution what is creating the notion of time?
It's a very good question, because it brings us centrally to the basic and most fundamental paradox of the coexistence of eternity and time. The real answer to your question is that this is a supramental paradox that the mind cannot understand, because to the mind, either of them is a separate reality. The mind can experience eternity as a beginningless and endless continuity, or the mind can experience time as a beginningless and endless flow. But in either case, we find an exclusive experience, which is the nature or the modality of existence in mind nature. But to the supermind, the two can coexist. And the coexistence of the two can be seen as a static event in eternity and a dynamic event in time. It's the same in two places. When we say a static event in eternity, it is like saying that, Sri Aurobindo talks about it at places, that the idea of an event, like even in Savitri, it begins with that, across the path of the divine event, the divine event is the event that is like an image in eternity, a static image in eternity. It is, so to say, like the symbol of Sri Aurobindo, ever present in the eternal. But that is the meaning of time. It is the structure of time in the flow, in the continuity. So basically, the involution and the evolution, when just as we move from continuity to discreteness, in substance, when we talk about spirit and matter, we similarly move from continuity to discreteness in consciousness when we talk about eternity and time. Time is the discreteness of the eternal event as a repeated perennial process of involutions and evolutions.
So can I say that time is one of the form of experience of the consciousness, because consciousness also has become matter, right? That itself is paradoxical. So it's like the consciousness experiences itself as time, in a way. It's like a dimension, one dimension of its own experience. Is that?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It is one dimension of its own experience. It is simultaneously experiencing itself as continuity and as the discrete movement that we know as time, creating progression or creating change or knowing itself as a gradual evolution.
When we say existence existence and manifestation, is it analogical to saying spirit and matter, or Purusha and Prakriti, or there is no one-to-one analogy there?
No, there can be an analogy. It is certainly an analogy, but it is not a, an analogy is a correspondence. It is not a, equivalence. These are symbols. As you said, spirit and matter are symbols, but matter is not the only form of manifestation.
Sure. Yeah,
ultimately,
sure.
Spirit and matter are both forms of manifestation, you may say, or are both forms of existence. Matter is also a form of pure existence. It is pure existence without consciousness, which is manifest. So too, spirit is a form of existence, but also a form of manifestation. So, but symbolically, you may align spirit to existence and matter to manifestation, that kind of thing.
Thank you, Devashishtha. So, I mean, so if we try to actually distinguish, I mean, kind of, you know, what metaphysically try to distinguish between existence and manifestation, it might become a little too, you know, pedagogical. Would you say that, or is it?
No, not necessarily. It is pedagogical in a way because, you know, in, again, it's the difference between existence or experience in the mind and experience in the supermind. But we can only imagine experience in the supermind. We cannot experience it at this point. So there is a reality to these things for us. In our experience, we experience them separately. That's the reason why Purusha and Prakriti, soul and, you know, can nature, existence and manifestation become realities for our experience. But even as we experience them as realities, something in us knows that a trenchant divide is being made when in reality, in fact, somewhere this divide does not exist. That's the problem of mind. That in a sense, mind cannot help but look at things in terms of polarities. But at the same time, its deepest intuition tells it that these polarities don't work perfectly. They are firstly interdependences, and secondly, they are unities and identities.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully we are not going too off topic here, but if we, if the mind itself realizes that these are polarities and tries to unite itself in, unite these polarities, that is, it attempts to, but in that case, is it simply playing in with itself, or is there really an attempt to transcend that mind when we try to unite those polarities using the mind itself?
Yeah, no, mind can actually, it's legitimate for mind to attempt to hold these separately, to unite them in the experience of an interdependence and to transcend them and know them as identities, unities and identities. The mind can sort of do all these depending on what mind consciousness we are talking about. So it is, when we say mind, we are also talking about a whole gradation of phenomena, which ultimately reaches to a point where the golden lid of the overmind is reached, and the supermind can be reflected. You know, Sri Aurobindo talks about the dividing line between supermind and overmind as being like a kind of a membrane. Like a, he calls it a sort of a fold of dissimilar similarity. You see, it's a very, again, a very paradoxical sort of transition created by consciousness. So when we talk about mind is also not a fixed thing. Mind is a whole range of possible experiences, ultimately moving into supermind.
Thank you, Devishtha. Beautiful.
So, can we say that the paradox also in the mind remains as that it looks at the form as something separate from the that which is inhabiting it, Whereas in the world, in the logic of the spirit, there is nothing but itself that can exist. So in that case, the form itself is also itself. Like not,
yes.
It's not really separate. So basically, it's the same thing is expressing in different ways. One is inhabitant, and
yes.
The other is the
yes.
Inhabiting.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Very, absolutely true. And remember, that is exactly how he starts that with that line, which shows that very difference. But there has been an involution of this unity into the dividing mind. A plunge into self-oblivion by which the ever-present sense of the complete oneness is lost, and the play of separative difference phenomenal, because the real unity in difference remains unabridged behind, comes into the forefront as a dominant reality. So, yes, exactly, to mind the inhabitant and the habitation, dehi and dehin, become two separate realities. While to supermind there is nothing but the one self-experiencing in multiple forms. This is actually what we're saying, the kind of lapse of prajnana. The supramental prajnana calling act of consciousness to divide its multiplicity from its oneness, and establishing thereby the many as the fragmented, sort of particles of the one, which is impossible in supermind, but possible when that veil is cast upon its own reality, and that prajnana with a veil on it is mind. Similarly, one may say samgyana with a veil on it is life, and agyana with a veil on it is matter.
Debashita, can you explain the difference between dehi and dehin?
Well, that distinction is made in the Gita. And it is exactly as Keka was saying, the inhabitant and the dress, the habit. And that difference is really one having to do with nature and the plunge of the transcendent into nature. That is those are the two creations. That is what I tried to explain in the beginning by talking about the holocaust of Prakriti and the holocaust of Purusha. The fact that Prakriti's holocaust proceeds by creating the ground of all that we are here, the principles, cosmic principles, that in combination will form the deha, the body, the vehicle. And the second, the holocaust of the Purusha, by which the transcendent consciousness will become self-individualized in these vessels, these adharas, these dehas, as the inhabitant within dehin, and then the evolution of the two, the evolution of the deha as the evolution of nature forms, and the evolution of the dehin as the process of rebirth by which consciousness becomes master of nature.
The Bhashista, that the Purusha Sukta in the Rig Veda, that is the
yes.
description of involution, right? Because it's the sacrifice of the gods have tied the Purusha as the sacrificial beast or the Pashu. And
yes.
they have put him in the fire, and off that sacrificial fire, the seasons are born, the humans are born, the creatures are born. So this, it also, that same holocaust also brings forth Prakriti, or
yes.
outward nature.
Yes, yes. You know, talking about that, I've been reflecting lately about the beautiful myth of Sati, which I believe describes the other holocaust, the holocaust of Prakriti. Because in the myth of Sati, the word Daksha itself means the dividing principle. Daksha is, mind. And Sati's being born to Daksha is first and foremost the birth of that very descent of the supramental Prakriti into the dividing mind, into the realm of the dividing mind. Now, the yajna that Daksha puts on is a yajna to the cosmic gods, but not a yajna to the transcendent. So, the real yajna that takes place in Daksha's sacrifice, which actually, in a sense, Daksha's sacrifice to the cosmic gods, is the mind creation sacrifice to the overmind, to the cosmic reality. But in a way, it does not affirm the root of unity that is above. So Sati, in immolating herself, is the real yajna that Daksha is trying to approximate. She is the yajna of the divine Prakriti. And the fruit of that yajna is her self-multiplication, because that will end up in her dismemberment and in the sort of distribution of her body parts all over the land, all over the world. So that, in a sense, is the holocaust of Prakriti, by which Supreme Shakti divides itself as an act of sacrifice and becomes the ground for the manifestation of spirit.
I would like to, get a better, more detail what Lopa was saying. Either Lopa or Devashish, could you please a little more detail about what that...
The Purusha Shakti? That is in the Rig Veda. That Sukta in the Rig Veda is talking about the sacrifice of Purusha. So Purusha is tied to a stake. It's like the ancient sacrifice where, you actually sacrifice an animal. So Purusha it's the self-sacrifice of Purusha, dismembering himself, breaking up. Only part of him is going to be used in the sacrifice. Part of him remains above, forever unsacrificed. But the lower part is going to be cut and going to become the ground of the many. It's the one becoming the many in that sense. I don't know if Lopa wants to go into some more detail about the Purusha Shukta.
Actually, this Sukta has lots of images. So, like, very first it starts with that Purusha has 1,000 heads and he stands 10 feet from the earth. I mean, all these things could be very symbolic and meanings in a very occult plane. So, I'm not sure. And then he becomes Virat. And I know it's this Virat word is used in Savitri also, in the same kind of description.
Yes.
And then there are some sort of beings called gods. So it seems that there were gods before this holocaust of Purusha. So they are the ones who catch Purusha and sacrifice him in the fire.
Right.
Very interesting, actually. I mean, later on, maybe we'll catch up with it.
Yeah,
interestingly, I was looking, Vladimir has done a whole course on the Veda here, and there's a whole lecture that he has given on this Purusha Sukta, which is quite fascinating. I was looking at it just yesterday, and I plan to sort of go through it, but it is very interesting.
Debashita, is there a way I can get hold of that, because I've been sort of trying to wrestle with the Purusha Sukta for a long time?
Yeah, Actually, can I read the actual sacrifice part of it? I have the English translation of that.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yes.
Just 1 second, Sitaram. Let me finish this thread. That is there a way we can get to Vladimir's lecture?
Let me see. Actually, because they're being offered for a course over here, because some of his students also asked for it, and the people here were a little reluctant. So I'll have to ask them and see. Maybe I'll let you know by email what is possible.
Yeah, if it is possible, if there is any ambiguity, I think it's not. We should not get there.
Actually, I have another question to follow up question to Sati. Is there any? I was reading the actual Kumar Sambhavam by Kalidas for the last couple of days, and looking at the actual Sati and how the Veerabhadra comes and the subsequent events. What is the significance of that? Actually, the Sati's news goes back to Shiva, and he comes out of his meditation, and a sweat is dropped, and Veerabhadra is born. He goes and destroys the entire Dakshayagna. So who is really Parvati? Ashtadash Shaktipithas, you touched upon the 18 places where Sati's parts fell and all that. I just want to know a little bit about how the occult significance of Sati's rebirth. Here we're talking about birth and rebirth. Again,
yes.
It's Supreme Prakriti. He is taking a rebirth into Parvati.
Yes.
And the Shiva, who is really transcendent, something of very ferocious nature coming out of him and destroying that yajna. I mean,
yes.
it's all very. Can you just please just explain the things?
Yes, I mean, I think there can be a lot deeper sort of study done on this, and as in the case of the Purusha Sukta, every symbol has got some meaning to it. But in absolute essence, in its essential form, the question you raise is a very good one. And Daksha and the Yajna of Daksha is the Yajna of the ignorance, is the Yajna of the mind creation. And that Yajna is an approximation, just as the evolutionary process at any stage produces approximations. And those approximations, so because there is an involution, it starts off already with the assumption of an involution, because just like in Savitri, it starts off in the middle, but it's talking about a beginning, the simple dawn. So similarly, in the story of Daksha as a sacrifice, Daksha is the mind creation that is offering its reality to some higher principle, but all it manages is the cosmic gods, because it cannot really arrive at the truth which is beyond it. Okay, just like, for example, as an analogy, you can think about the great revolution in thought that has taken place since the middle of the 19th century. All the various movements in philosophy, in art, in science, in psychology that have taken place and going on still are tending in the direction of something beyond mind. But they cannot see that route. They cannot offer their sacrifice to the truth. They can only offer their sacrifice to approximations of that truth. So in that milieu, something from the transcendent is born. And that which is born is not really recognized, but it comes to do its work. Its work, its secret work, is to actually make that link with the transcendent. Now, it does that through its own self-immolation, its own yajna, its own sacrifice. Now, that sacrifice calls down the power from above. Now that power from above, when it comes down into the ignorant creation, is often a great destruction. This is what is being talked about here. It's a destruction of the ignorant yajna. And that destruction of the ignorant yajna ultimately ends up in distributing as its prasada the fragmented body of the prakriti, the pure, sort of higher consciousness that had come down. The involution of that higher principle is made cosmic due to that distribution. Okay, now that establishes a new ground, as it were. At every stage that establishes a new ground, a new manifestation can occur at that point. Now there is a rebirth of Prakriti, the rebirth of Shakti. The rebirth of Shakti as Parvati is no longer taking place at the level of the dividing mind. It is taking place in the Parvata, as the daughter of Himalaya. So she is now actually being born at a higher plane, at a plane from which she can rule, she can sort of oversee the evolution of consciousness on earth. So this is, on the one hand, the Sati represents Prakriti, while Parvati represents Paraprakriti. Paraprakriti that is being manifest at the tops where the form and formless meet. That's why, interestingly, this figure, we can also think of her as Aditi over there. This figure repeats probably its origin in the Kena Upanishad, where in his journey to find the mysterious unknowable power, ultimately Indra reaches the tops of the mountain and there meets Uma, who points above to that which cannot be manifest, you see, the unnameable. So she is the firstborn of the unnameable in that sense. She is the Paraprakriti, and that second birth establishes her in that form after the ground has been created by her through the first birth.
Thank you, Devashishta. That's very beautiful. I have one more question related actually to our two follow-up questions to that. I don't want to take this discussion of Parvati's birth, but kind of little unclear about the distinction between that rebirth and the concept of avatara. What is the difference here? Like, is it like an avatara or is it like a rebirth? I mean, is that an avatar?
Yeah, we can see these are where the notion of Shakti avatar comes in. Yeah, definitely. I mean, the notion of Shakti avatar is not sufficiently clarified in our Indian tradition, but it's in the tantras and in the notion of Shakti that Shakti avatar comes in. And certainly we can look at this as the births of the Shakti avatar.
Actually, another interesting thing that happens is Daksha is not just killed, his head is replaced and he is again transformed after the exam.
All these very mystic kind of occurrences have very powerful symbolic meanings. I am not at this point, and also to take us a little far afield, but Kapali Shastri has talked about this replacement of the head by the horse.
Goat.
In his case, goat. Is it goat?
Yeah, it's a goat.
I see.
But nevertheless, he is transformed. He is with a goat's head, but he is transformed at the end of it. I don't know the significance of the goats. And the etymology of the word Uma, again, going back to this work of Kalidas, like Uma was referring to Parvati is Parvata's daughter. Uma is don't do it. Ma is don't. Who is hello, like referring to a young girl. So it's essentially her mother asking her not to get into tapas. She saw these tendencies and she's asking her not to get into tapas of Shiva.
Yes. It's very beautiful.
Thank you, Devashishi. It's a beautiful meaning you gave for the Varamarsambham. Actually, now there is a lot more meaning to reading it. Parvati's birth, it's beautifully said.
Yeah, I think all these Puranic myths have very, very deep significance. Once one sees them in the light of Sri Aurobindo, a lot comes to sort of reveal itself, which otherwise one doesn't really understand.
Yeah, I have the translation of actual Purush Sukta, but I think maybe it might be... Maybe I'll just send it out, then read it. I think it's a whole topic by itself. All the 24 verses of the Purush Sukta, the sacrifice is described in detail here.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be nice.
I'll try to send it by email.
Devashishda.
Yes.
So in the Veda, in the Vedas and the Upanishads and the Puranic stories, the reason they are all always exposed as stories with symbols rather than metaphysics, is that because of the style of the time, or is it because of, you know, a need to quote unquote hide the knowledge from those who were not ready, or is it that there were other metaphysical texts too, but which we are not using much these days?
You know, the Vedanta is the root of the metaphysical knowledge. And so Veda, I mean, if you look at it historically, then Veda represents a kind of a symbolic statement of occult truths, of very high truths at a time when only very few initiates were ready to receive it. And Sri Aurobindo calls this the symbolic age. So that happens, but then the inevitable fossilization takes place. It becomes externalized. The symbol is lost in the spirit is lost, and only the shell of the symbol remains. So at that point, the Vedanta comes, and that is the root of the metaphysics. By the time Puranas come, I mean, it's difficult to explain, but some people feel that Vedanta also became very distant because people could not, you know, relate to these high philosophic principles. So once again, the occult truths of these phenomena were laid out. You know, it is the reality of these principles as beings, as persons, and their leelas, their deeds, that we find in the Puranas. And they fascinate us because, in a sense, they connect to some very deep layer of recognition within ourselves, where we, you know, can relate to these beings, and also we can somehow intuit, without even understanding in its fullness, we can intuit some very high philosophical truths in the lives of these gods. So that is what Purana achieved. But you see, already in Purana, there is a lot of Vedanta that is already incorporated. Puranas are also partly self-interpreted texts, so that there is a sense that, you know, a real understanding of Puranas can only come in the light of Vedanta.
Actually, it's quite intriguing, the question that Shyam is bringing out. you know, does it have anything to do with this evolution of the spirit becoming matter? Like, you know, that's the our evolution is about, right? Like,
yeah.
Objectification of consciousness, and in that process, this was like an inevitable thing, which Sharma's pointing out.
Yeah, Sri Aurobindo also looks at it in that evolutionary way when he talks about the social cycles. That first, in the evolution of consciousness in human society, there is a symbolic age where things are very plastic, but at the same time perfectly suited to certain symbols. It's, we haven't separated ourselves sufficiently with our minds to understand these things as principles. We just live them. And then there is a certain stage where that separation takes place because falsehood also enters. So there is a need to know the principles by which truth manifests itself. And then there is a further involution into the vital level, where these principles become, as it were, manifest through all these stories, through all these beings, etc. So it is a progressive involution that is represented, and these beings are gods who have bodies, and in a sense, closer to the differentiated reality that we experience as spirit in matter. So yeah, there is that kind of progression involved.
But Devashish, I have a question about the Puranas, where you can't miss this portion where you constantly see some kind of a bartering going on.
Yeah.
Okay, you do this, you will get this. Basically, kamyas, everything, most of, there is, granted there is a Vedantic truth, which will basically, or something in higher, which one can into it, but there is a by and large, you see lot of you know, bartering and lot of this bargaining with God and all this type of things. You do this, you take, you get this.
That's true.
Yeah, you read once, you get this. You read this two times, and it is like our spam and anything else.
No, I think those were added later. You can distinctly see that the poetic quality is different in many shlokas. The first part has a certain lightness and beauty and rhythm to it. And then those later part that you're saying, the do it once, you get this. And
actually, the stories,
those are just padding.
Stories themselves have built into, it's not, it probably it is the same thing. But you see that there is, I'm not...
No. Actually, even the Lakshmi's, Vishnu Sahasranamam, Lalita Sahasranamam, each comes with its own palastuti.
That's okay.
There also they talk about, okay, if you read this once, you will be happy like this.
That is, I'm, okay, basically.
Because it's written by the same person as original the four.
Oh, that's not really obvious, right? It may have been added later too.
Yeah, palastuti part is not what I'm talking about. For example, a lot of times the typical qualities of, you know, like satisfying like immediate material needs and these type of things were built into the stories itself sometimes.
Yeah, that's possible because you see there is a lot of mixture that takes place. I mean, even when we study art, we find that you see Puranas are not codified that early. Sri Aurobindo has a place where he says Puranas are very ancient and may have coexisted with the Vedas, but they are codified very late. They're codified only during Gupta period or a little earlier, from in the period between Kushan and Gupta, from only after the first century AD, we find codification of Puranas. So if we compare it with, let's say, the visual evidence, similar thing is going on. There are lots of all these, you know, propitiatory cults. Yaksha cults are usually exactly what you're saying. They are kind of, you know, bargaining or bartering. You know, these are more primitive forms of occult practice. And there is a syncretism that takes place between those and the Vedantic truth. So some mixture is inevitable over there.
So essentially the invitation is the most important thing, however which way it works for you, how it invites you to explore, invites you to the journey. Yeah, even if it is a bribe, so what? Still, if it invites you in the right direction.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I mean, it seems that, you know, a scholarly reverse engineering of the symbols is like very error prone without the actual experience to go with it, right?
Yes, absolutely. This is again where you need to, exercise the discrimination of the Hamsa, where you have to pick out the, Kheera from the, water. I mean, without the root above, you cannot understand the mixture below.
So, it sounds like that primitive and the supreme, like they started coexisting from the very beginning, and then the network between them is kind of getting bigger every day. I mean, with time.
Yes, quite true. The network is getting more complex. So, Manoj Das has a nice story where he talks about Rakshasa's rebirths, talking about rebirths. He says Rakshasa's over time started getting reborn as Asuras. Then he has a nice story about the last Asura, The poor fellow finally gets reborn as a human being because it's no longer possible to distinguish him. Distinguish between the Asura and the human. The mixture between good and bad becomes so complex that it's no longer possible to maintain that clear-cut division.
Oh, but is there a real difference? I mean, I was thinking that the difference itself is not really so much of it's not so discrete, but just that discrete for us to talk about. But I thought it was more like properties than a distinct being, which is an Asura.
Well, at the occult level, it is there. That's the reason why it's possible for transformation to take place, and embodiment and also the purification process is possible, because all the parts of our being can make choices of will. And at the occult level, there definitely is a very distinct division between Deva and Asura.
I mean, they are like energies that can coexist in man. So man could have several Asuras in him, plus human energies and some divine energies.
Yeah.
We just put a being around that energy and we call it Asura, because it has properties of being able to move from one Adhara to another. So it's like a being. I mean, that's how I would understand.
It's probably like a being. There is, as you're saying, portions and principles are forces that are at work, and we temporarily express some of these forces. We may also give a formation to some of these forces, which is...
I don't think we can't hear you anymore, Devashishtha. Hello? Can anybody else hear me?
Yes, I think Devashish is having problem.
Yeah, okay.
Continue?
Yes. Can I ask that question? Actually, Devashishtha, this was a kind of puzzling me for quite some time. Most of the situations in Puranas and Bhagavatam, Ramayana, everywhere else, wherever I find Indra's story, it is kind of below the Devas. Nothing for all the where you find extreme jealousy and underhand tactics by Indra, Ahalya story, Govardhan story, and Vali, Kakasura, many instances wherever in the, always kind of in bad light. So why is this? Is there any significance to this, or is it simply beyond our comprehension to understand what this Indra is, and or is this Indra different from Vedic Indra?
Yeah, there is a change of role that takes place over time. Exactly how or why this happens, we are not clear about. But, you know, there is between the Puranic period and the Vedic period, you see, actually, if you do a historical study of these things, you find that there are gaps. And, you know, though, say, between Vedanta and Veda also, though there is a sense of continuity, there is also a sense of difference. So there will be, you know, statements in the Upanishads that will sort of point to the kind of, you know, the fact that there are things in the Veda that are not that desirable. Again, in the Gita, you know, they'd say that there is only as much water in the Veda as there is in a well for, you know, and then the concept of yajna is redefined. Now, all this is because Veda has deteriorated in its inner significance. And so there is a certain kind of a negative light thrown on those practices.
Oh God.
There's a power fluctuation going on here. We've just sort of corrected that right now, so
okay.
Hopefully it will hold for some time now. What I'm saying is that by the Puranic period, worship of Indra is continuing, but the inner significance has been completely lost. We know this because even in the image archive, when we look at the images of early Indian art, we find that Indra is being worshipped almost like a yaksha. You see, there is propitiation going on to Indra. Yajnas are there, but it has become extremely external. So one of the decisive moments of the later Indian sort of tradition is the replacement of Indra as the highest god by Krishna. And that takes place through the story of Govardhan you know, the sort of overcoming of the power of Indra by Krishna, just by the single sort of, you know, lifting of a mountain with his finger. So, you know, the Puranas, there's a lot of this denigration of Indra that goes on, partly because, mostly because that the public practice of Indra worship is still quite common, but the inner significance has been totally lost.
Yes.
Dibhashita, what is a yaksha?
Yakshas are nature gods. Sri Aurobindo has likened them to the Greek nature gods like dryads and naiads and things like that. They are, you know, the sort of spirits of nature, yakshas and yakshis. They cause, vegetation to grow and the occult events of nature to take place. They are related with wealth and fertility and things like that.
And they are worshippers of Shiva ultimately, and their leader is Kubera, their capital is Alaka.
Yes, because Kubera is god of wealth.
He is the god of Yakshas also.
Yeah. Yes, he is the god of Yakshas, or lord of Yakshas. And then Yakshas and Ganas, they you know, become part of the retinue of Shiva, particularly Ganas, who are also a kind of Yaksha. Ganas originally are a variety of yaksha. They turn up as these little potbelly dwarves. You know, they are a variety of yaksha. And they become completely a retinue of Shiva. And then, of course, Ganesha is their master.
What
so,
about...
pramathas? Pramathas are the same.
Pramathas are beings of desire. These beings, all yakshas, pramathas, gandharvas, apsaras, all belong to antariksha. They belong to vital, heavens. Heaven worlds are of the vital. Life heavens.
So Devashishda.
Sorry.
Go ahead. Go ahead. No,
We were having a little discussion about this Indra when you were offsite. Mishamo is mentioning that, Indra is some plane which is much beyond our pure ethics. So we should not be able to understand. So in that context, I was thinking holding the difference without the falsehood, which is probably happening in the overmind level. I mean, definitely to human, as a human being, we feel it is, how can that be rationally possible? So it's not just paradoxical, it's kind of, it really violates our sense of rationality. Even looking,
give me an example.
Holding the difference, like overmind has that difference, the point of difference, entry of difference, and at the same time it doesn't have a falsehood. So
no.
At least for our plane, we are continuously struggling against falsehood and ignorance. I mean, like total unconsciousness,
yeah.
All these things. But in overmind, in spite of not having those things, it still holds the difference.
Yeah, so there is difference but harmony. Even a difference which may seem to be completely contradictory to our eyes, but still it is harmony, because they recognize things to all be embodying some divine play.
Yeah, but the difference as a reality, I mean, seeing the difference,
yes,
as a reality, it seems to violate our rationality, and it seems to be cunning in a way. I don't know if I'm making sense.
Cunning.
You mean the kind
it's
of...
It's not a helpless... Yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem to be just a helplessness like us. It's more like deliberate sort of... cunning way.
Yeah, you see that cunning, what you're talking about, it actually, in the Puranas, etc., there is this notion of cunning, or even of some other kind of lower sort of things like jealousy and, greed, desire and all that, which are expressed by these gods. And these things are actually, you're quite right, in the sense that they are the projection of realities in which these kind of feelings don't exist on the vital plane. So when we look at it from the perspective of ignorance and falsehood, that's the kind of appearance it takes on. And when it projects itself into these lower planes, that's the kind of appearance it manifests. So as a result, you may say that this is the compromised reality of the gods in the lower worlds. This is part of the reason why in Savitri you have the three soul forces who are living in quite a compromised reality. They are maintaining their own purity, but they have to coexist with the darkened opposites. And those darkened opposites are successful in giving a different kind of appearance to those gods and goddesses themselves. And that is what we receive. We see that. And in many ways, we express our... our take on those gods and goddesses in that way.
So, Devashishda, when you say, going back just a couple of sentences earlier, when you say that Sri Aurobindo says that the yakshas are sort of equivalent to the nature gods of the Greeks,
Is it that any yogi who comes in contact with these planes, like the planes where the yakshas live, is able to correlate that with the Greek nature gods? Or is it more Sri Aurobindo's scholarship that allows him to do that correlation?
Yeah, partly it is his scholarship, but also partly it is the fact that these forms in which we see these beings are also a double creation. I mean, they partly are human cultural forms in which the invisible reality of these beings casts itself. So there is a being, for example, behind, you know, the river goddess, let's say. Now, this river goddess, you know, you may put up a cultural form into which it will inhabit. It's just like inhabiting material bodies, but these are vital occult bodies, mental vital occult bodies. But this being has a reality of its own as well, which ultimately transcends all our forms. So when he says that Yaksha god is parallel or synonymous with a Greek god or goddess, he is casting his inner occult eye on these forms and seeing the same inhabitant.
Yeah. So that means when you say he's seeing the same inhabitant, that means that kind of indicates that he has seen them in, he has come across them as part of the Greek tradition, and so he sees the same. I mean,
yeah. Or he has seen the reality of these. Sri Aurobindo has seen these in terms of forces and forms. You see, that's the thing. I mean, the tremendous wideness and comprehensibility and integrality of his vision can make and unmake the gods. You know, he can see them as the Brahman, he can see them as the projection of the Brahman, as principles, as well as beings. All these coexist in his vision.
Yeah, I guess it's so vast and complex that it's kind of, it's fascinating, but at the same time, it just escapes that the comprehension is just difficult to comprehend in itself.
Yeah, that's why, you know, it's only, as he says, only the higher we go, the clearer we see. The lower, the many are only explained by the one.
Beautiful.
You know, I was thinking this kind of vision, that when you go high and you have a better field of vision, we get intuitions or little glimpses of it in dreams. No, yeah. In dreams sometimes it's sequenceless, but some witness behind knows that it makes complete sense. And when you wake up, it doesn't make sense, but you knew it when you were asleep, that you knew it made sense.
That's true, because the consciousness operating there understands the symbolic logic of the dream, which you miss when you come back into your rational mind.
Yeah, and those are great invitations to realize that in a conscious mind, without being asleep, you can comprehend or apprehend.
Yes.
So there was just the... Oops. Hello.
Dalal's Night School of Sadhana is a very good book.
Who? Dalal? Oh, okay.
Yes, Dalal's.
Oh, I see.
Dreams Night School of Sadhana.
Oh, he dropped again.
That is very nice, actually. Thanks.
Oh, there's a booklet like that. Is that like his other booklets where he has collected mothers and share business?
Yeah. It's separate. It's same size as Growing Within, Living Within series. Basically, same thickness. Basically, the title of the book is Dreams, the Night School of Sadhana. It says.
Oh, I think we have it. But it's
That's
a small book.
One book of
we have a very thin, small book. Maybe it's a smaller font.
No, it's the same book. I'm talking.
We don't have.
Okay, so I think maybe we should read, what do you say, read another paragraph and conclude for today?
Yes. Shall I read or?
Yeah, read.
Birth then is a necessity of the manifestation of the Purusha on the physical plane. But his birth, whether human or any other, cannot be in this world order an isolated accident or a sudden excretion of soul of a soul into physicality without any preparing past to it or any fulfilling hereafter. In a world of involution and evolution, not of physical form only, but of conscious being through life and mind to spirit, such an isolated assumption of life in the human body could not be the rule of the individual soul's existence. It could be quite meaningless and inconsequential arrangement, a free for which the nature and system of things here have no place, a contrary violence which would break the rhythm of spirit's self-manifestation. The intrusion of such a rule of individual soul life into an evolutionary spiritual progression would make it an effect without cause and cause without effect. It would be a fragmentary present without a past or a future. The life of the individual must be the same rhythm of significance, the same law of progression as the cosmic life. Its place in that rhythm cannot be a stray, purposeless intervention. It must be an abiding instrumentation of the cosmic purpose. Neither in such an order can we explain an isolated advent, a one birth of soul in the human body, which would be its first and last experience of the kind, by a previous existence in other worlds with a future before it in yet other fields of experience. For here, life upon earth, life in the physical universe, is not and cannot be a casual perch for the wanderings of the soul from world to world. It is a great and slow development needing, as we know now, incalculable spaces of time for its evolution. Human life is itself only a term in a graded series through which the secret spirit in the universe develops gradually his purpose and works it out finally through the enlarging and ascending individual soul consciousness in the body. This ascent can only take place by rebirth within the ascending order. An individual visit coming across it and progressing on some other line elsewhere could not fit into the system of this evolutionary existence.
So here he is taking up and answering some of the arguments he has recorded previously in this chapter regarding rebirth. And these all exist as possibilities once we admit rebirth. Is it that if there is such a thing as a soul being born, that something separate from the nature body comes from somewhere else, either from the Supreme, takes a birth and goes back into the Supreme? It is the argument that he has introduced that is what appears to us in our phenomenal becoming. People come and go. Human beings are born, they live a while, and then they die. And we never see them again. Instead, other human beings come and take their place. So, what happens? Is it that there is a soul that appears just for one life and then disappears? Or is it that there is a succession of births, but it is not tied to Earth, that it may appear on other planes of consciousness or other worlds, and this sojourn on the Earth in one life is just the, you know, the perching of a bird that comes on one tree to sit a while and then move on to other trees, which are like the other worlds. So is its experience on this world only one particular such field of experience? And he's saying that neither of these can be true if it is indeed the case that the very meaning of birth is the self-revelation of Purusha in Prakriti. So there is an evolution of Prakriti going on, which is the evolution of forms and of nature, cosmic consciousness, but there is also an evolution of spirit, of consciousness going on in an individualized form, which is the evolution of Purusha. And therefore, just as we can see in front of our own eyes that the evolution of Prakriti is a long, slow, laborious process, taking millennia to move from one particular stage to another, so too, though this may be more accelerated and conscious, the evolution of Purusha will need a long succession of lives to arrive at its own self-revelation. So, you know, the contest, the sort of, you know, the gradual awakening of consciousness and unconsciousness and the contest between truth and falsehood is not something that is achieved in a few lifetimes and needs this kind of long sort of, you know, persistence, where what is given to it initially is a very precarious and short existence in a body. So bodies and lives are at first the conditions given by nature in her evolution to the soul, to the Purusha, to inhabit, grow and master. As it grows more and more master, it comes to greater power of control over Prakriti, over its instruments, and ultimately this power of control ought to be able to exert itself on the physical so that it may control the longevity of the body and ultimately become the determinant of immortality in the physical form. That is when the indivisible Purusha Prakriti or Ishvara Shakti will be manifest in nature, in the ignorance, as the self-revelation of the evolving ignorance.
Why individual's birth should follow the same rhythm as the cosmic rhythm? I did not understand the logic of it. Can you explain that part again?
Yes, because mind you, as he has explained earlier, this is not merely an evolution of cosmic principles. It is an evolution of the Supreme Person. That is exactly one of those very subtle points where Sri Aurobindo's philosophy asserts its theism. In other words, that not only is there some kind of Brahman as an impersonal being that has become its self-manifesting, cosmic, reality, but also there is a divine person, a Purusha, Purushottama, who is manifesting his personhood using this cosmic manifestation of Prakriti as his home, as his abode. So if that is the case, then from the very beginning of the appearance of cosmic Prakriti, there must also appear this individual Purusha. individual Purusha, or what becomes self-projected or self-multiplied as the innumerable psychic entities seeding Prakriti with the possibility of individual evolution, coexists with the cosmic evolution of Prakriti. Prakriti and Purusha are coexistent in the evolution. Prakriti evolves as the cosmic ignorance, and Purusha evolves as the psychic entity that inhabits the forms of this evolving Prakriti and ultimately becomes the psychic being and finally the Purusha that manifests its own divinity. So that's why it is coexistent, coterminous, exists at the same time from the very beginning and through time with the cosmic reality, which is the manifestation of Prakriti in the universe.
Thank you, Devashish.
Shall we end here today?
Yes, let's end here.